rogue UK Twitter account, The Secret Tory, is wanted for distracting the Tory government from concentrating on national self-impoverishment by forcing them to firefight puerile accusations instead. If you have any information relating to their identity, Crime Stoppers are offering a £500 community cash reward.
Yeah, Ben, it's Henry. You'll never guess what I just saw. Michael Gove! Yeah, really? No. There's no way I could have known I'm the Henry Morris who's been amateurishly lampooning his party's proto-fascist antics. What did he sound like? Well, come to think of it, he spoke with exactly the same voice
we do for him in the Tories. Rest in pieces, Secret Tory.
Don't panic, folks, you're on the right channel. This is the Running Tales podcast, and I'm Craig Lewis. But what you just heard was an extract from a Twitter video produced by the Secret Tory account. Now, that account, which has almost 200,000 followers, started life as a parody of the Conservative MP Marc Francois. And it's grown into, well, an often eviscerating look at the government, and even spawned a best-selling book called The Diary of a Secret Tory MP. Although it often bordered on the ridiculous, many pundits speculated the account was run by a disaffected MP or a Westminster insider. They were wrong. As a big reveal video, part of which you've just heard, showed the account was run by an otherwise unknown fitness instructor and, who would have thought, ultra runner called Henry Morris. And Henry is our guest on Running Tales this week. We took the chance to ask Henry what the inspiration behind The Secret Tory was, how it got so huge, and most importantly, all about his running. Henry has left a party lifestyle behind to run almost 50 ultra marathons, including one covering 110 miles. He spoke about how he runs to raise money and awareness for environmental causes, including the shocking threat posed to birds of prey by grouse moors. But I started our conversation by asking Henry what life has been like since the end of May when he outed himself as the Secret Tory, a move which led to media interviews on places like the BBC and Sky for The Guardian, and, interestingly, to being mocked by aging comics on GB News for daring to have a mullet in 2023.
I've got a four-week-old baby in the house, so it's been an extremely mad time. The baby came about a week after I outed myself, so I went from having Daily Mail journalists basically going through my bins and asking my neighbours about me to delivering a baby at home, which we did before the midwife got here, actually. It's our second kid, and it came really quickly. And we had a quiet day, and Ellie said, I think it's coming now. We need to ring the midwives. And then half an hour later, I had the baby in my arms, and it was here. So the last 4 weeks have been absolutely mad, and I haven't really stopped for air at any point. But the reception for the Secret Tory has been largely great. Obviously, well, not obviously, but everyone was saying, well, we didn't think it was you. But then who did they think it was?
Yeah. And for those people who might not know, explain to people what the Secret Tory was and I suppose still is encapsulated now in yourself.
That's a really good question. I don't think anyone's asked me that. The Secret Tory was a bored personal trainer in a gym who was sick of incompetent politicians, as far as I could tell, running the country into the ground. So I set up a parody account one day in between my clients. I was in a small personal training studio, and in the gaps between, I started pretending to be backbench Tory MP called Marc Francois, who I personally think is an idiot. And it went down really well, and everyone thought it was really funny, and I immediately picked up like 20,000 followers in not very long, in a few weeks. And then that morphed into the Secret Tory, because I thought I found by doing it, something I've always wanted to do is write, but I've always been doing other things. I run a music festival, and I'm a personal trainer, and I run ultra marathons, and never really sat down to do it. But having built myself this audience, so I started writing on there, and the writing went really well received. I did a plague diary during lockdown in the style of Samuel Pepys, in the style of Marc Francois. And off the back of that, I got an agent. And off the back of that, I thought maybe I need to broaden this a bit. So I became the Secret Tory, so I could sort of take pot shots of a whole setup there rather than just one MP. And off the back of that, that did really well. And then that sort of grew. And people were thinking, is this a real MP? Because lots of the stuff I was saying is obviously nonsense, but also a lot of the stuff our politicians are currently saying is obviously nonsense. And so the sort of lines of reality are getting increasingly blurred. And I think it says a lot about the current state of things, but large numbers of people thought I was a real MP blowing the whistle on my colleagues. And then I guess it sort of reached a critical mass. And then 4 weeks ago, I thought, I'm going to unmask myself here, thinking not much would come of it, because I wouldn't have done it at the same time as this baby was born if I thought it would have blown up like it has. Nonetheless, it has. And here I am talking to you.
I don't know if it was a complete surprise for you, because the Secret Tory had managed to find you quite a substantial Twitter following. You managed to get a book out of it. I wonder whether the bigger surprise was how much it took off in the first place.
Yeah. You know what? I've always known I'm a funny person with my mates. And I've always, you know, felt like a funny person. I'm always with people laughing. But I never really thought I'm that funny guy who can make everyone laugh. And then I'd started doing this and everyone started laughing. And I thought, oh, maybe I am. And so it felt very nice for your ego to get 200,000 followers laughing at your jokes, or some of it, at least some of them are anyway. And so, I mean, after settling into the pleasant surprise of finding out I was funny, yeah, it was sort of quite nice. But honestly, I just thought the three people were going to say, right, you're not a Tory MP, I'm disappointed, or why have you been winding us up like this? Which a lot of people did. I get like some really amusing death threats and things from, like, a weird name with loads of numbers behind it in my DMs saying, you know, I'm responsible for everything that's happened, which is richly ironic, isn't it? But yeah, no, I just thought I'd piss a few people off. I honestly did. And the rest would be like, shrug their shoulders and move on. But instead, I think largely because I've got tattoos and a mullet, people have got really curious. We don't know people like me.
Well, yeah, I think people maybe, or a lot of people following it, I thought rather strangely, but they got this idea that it must be some sort of Westminster insider doing this.
Exactly.
And when it turned out to be a personal trainer with a mullet, as you say, it really shocked them. Yeah. And actually, some people got quite angry about it.
Yeah, maybe some people got really angry about it. In fact, there was a really good bit on GB News where these three people who pretend to be comedians have gone to watch their careers die, and they look at the stories of yesterday together. And they were looking at my one, and the best they could come up with were, this guy looks like he smells, which is a joke worthy of my 4-year-old, I think. Maybe a kid a bit older. And he looks unemployed, which I thought was really revealing about how they, you know, how they see the world and how they think about other people. And like, they're just really snootily looking down my noses in a really sort of, all they could come up with was stuff about my appearance. But like, they had absolutely nothing substantive to say whatsoever. And my favourite one was some bloke saying, no, he does look like an Australian, he does look like an MP, just of a small Australian suburb.
It's a big thing with the Aussies, is it, and the mullet. But one thing I was interested by was, I mean, obviously started off as this sort of parody of Marc Francois, but it developed, didn't it, as it became the Secret Tory. And I think it became a lot more, it was always political, wasn't it, but it became a lot stronger and a lot more critical rather than just jokes.
I found it really difficult because, like, in the first stage of it, everyone was being really flattering. This is the funniest account. Oh my God, everyone's got to follow this. And like, you get all these blue tick people following you. And I won't lie, like, really sort of, like I said before, it really flatters your ego. And so I was just like, oh, do jokes, people say they like me. That's a good deal, isn't it? But then some of the people saying they like me were the people I was taking shots at. And I've said this to other people, but there's a good Chris Morris interview when he says, if you're telling jokes as like the jester and to the court, and the court are laughing along with you, then yeah, then you're just a jester. What are you actually trying to achieve there? If you're not doing your job properly, if you want to just make people chuckle, then that's fine. But if you've got an objective, then sort of in the same way that I was flattered that people were laughing at me, you're flattering these MPs by giving them the attention. So they're happy to share it because, you know, they've laughed about it. So yeah, so then I moved it along a bit and I was like, I got sort of more focused. But then that got quite difficult because my voice coming out more just saying, I really object to the way you dehumanize refugees and turn them into a political pawn. So you can try and hang on to your seats because, you know, this plays with a certain group of the electorate when you're actually talking about real people who you've turned into a big mass faceless body who you've turned into the enemy when actually, you know, they've fled war zones or extreme situations to come here and are asking for help. So it just came out there. It's hard to be funny when you're doing that. So like, you've got to remember that people come to the account to be entertained and laugh, but also I want to get my thing out there and do my message. So I was having to strike that balance. And I think some days I get it right and some days I don't. When I sit, I don't have much time at the moment, so a lot of my tweets are just me being annoyed rather than being funny. It takes a little bit longer to be funny.
And then you mentioned there about that objective that you had. I mean, what was that objective? Just to get the message out there and hope other people...
I don't know. I had an objective. And I did an interview with The Guardian, and the sub-editor had a really nice time pulling out a line I said, slightly out of context, saying my sole objective is to destroy the Tories. That's not my sole objective. My sole objective is to try and make the world a better place. And one of those things in the way of that at the moment, I think, is the Tories. But yeah, I never sat down and thought, brainstormed and thought, what is my objective here? I'm not that organised a person. I think it's our duty to leave the planet a better place than we found it. And at the moment, we're doing the opposite. So in my small part, I've found I've got a voice and a platform now. So I've got my big Twitter following. I can talk to about the things that I think matter to me, and I can try and use comedy and jokes to, you know, make the points I want to make. But I'm just one small person, aren't I?
I know that one of the issues that there's a lot of issues that you sort of raised on the Twitter feed, but one of the big things that you're interested in is in environmental subjects and so on. And yeah, also that fits into, because we ought to move on to the running because we're a running podcast. Yeah. That fits into your running, doesn't it? And I know you do a lot of running and that you do a lot of that to raise money and raise the issue of various environmental issues as well.
But the last big long run I did was before lockdown. I'll have to try and contextualise it a bit, because driven grouse shooting, anyone who runs in the north of England is probably, or trail runs in the north of England, is probably run on a driven grouse moor or done an ultra in the north. And the driven grouse moors are places where posh people go to shoot red grouse for about £32,000 a day they'll pay for a group to go and do it. 32 grand. It's huge amounts of money involved. It's like The Spectator called it a screamingly elitist pastime. And to sustain the high densities of red grouse on those moorlands, you kill all the other animals there, basically, all the competing predators. So birds of prey, hen harriers, buzzards, red kites, vermin they call it, or I like to call them mammals, so stoats and foxes and weasels and things like that. So you just create this perfect ground for ground nesting birds. So and then... So it's basically this sort of killing field in every sense. They kill everything that comes near it to protect the red grouse, and then people pay to come and kill things on it. On top of which, they burn the grouse moor, destroying carbon sequestration. These peat bogs up there, which if you've ever run a run through one, is incredibly difficult to run through, retain huge amounts of carbon. I think we've got a fifth of the world's peat in our country, in the UK, and I can't do the stat off the top of my head, but... I think it's equivalent to our entire sort of carbon output for a year, and sort of a fraction of that. So it's amazing stuff. And so this bird called the hen harrier, which is functionally extinct in England because they've killed so many of them, the conservationists put trackers on them to locate where they die, because they always die on grouse moors. 72% of satellite tagged hen harriers die on or near driven grouse moors. And the grouse in interest deny they're anything to do with it, and the government's own data clearly states it's clear there's a link and there's something going on. So to draw attention to this, I'm getting there. Before lockdown, I ran between all the known locations of hen harriers on the satellite data across grouse moors across the country. So I did 250k on the grouse moors over the uplands from the Forest of Bowland across to the Nidderdale area of outstanding natural beauty, or raptor black hole, depending on how you want to look at it.
Have you always been into running, and has that always been something which you've used to boost causes as you've gone along?
I haven't always been into running. I used to be into partying and drinking drugs and just going at it really hard. Then in sort of my late 20s, I was overweight, and I thought I shouldn't be like this. So I went for a run one day, and I barely managed a mile. Like, yeah, I don't think I did manage a mile, and I sat on my sofa at the end of it, like, feeling nauseous all afternoon. And then the next day, I thought, either that's what I'm going to be like, or I'm going to do something about it. I just managed to run an extra 100 metres past whatever I'd done the day before. Felt exactly the same, but I just kept going out and making myself do it. And there was this route I had my eye on, which is about 3.5 miles, which just seemed to me impossible. It seemed completely impossible off the back of these first initial miles where I couldn't do them. But in 4 weeks, I managed to drag myself around it, puffing and panting and like still like, you know, snot running down my face and all that stuff. But I did it and I was like, I thought this was impossible. I've done that. What can I do next? So got up to 5 miles, got up to 10 miles. Thought, well, marathons, I thought the first few were impossible. So maybe I could do a marathon. So I signed up for a marathon. In the meantime, my brother was dabbling with ultras. And he was like, oh, this ultra near me, why don't you come and do that if you're training for a marathon? It'd be good practice to run further than a marathon for your marathon. So I did that. 33-mile Marlborough Down Challenge. Dragged myself around that in 7 hours or something horrible. And then I was like, wow, I've just run 33 miles. And so the marathon, I lost interest in straight away. And I was like, what can I do next? There's this race called the Hardmoors 110 on Cleveland Way, run by John Steele, an amazing event. And I was reading blogs about it. And then I was like, that definitely sounds impossible. So I had a stab at it. I signed up for it. And we're about sort of 3 years into my running now. I signed up for it. And I managed like 50 miles on the first go, pulled out at Saltburn halfway around. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to have another go. And did it again. Got to Whitby, got to 72 miles, pulled out again. And then I'm still going to have another go at it because I got to 72 this time. And did it again. I did the full 110. And at that point, I was like, wow, this is... And all of it, I was just framing it in my mind like that first mile. I couldn't get beyond that first mile. But I did it. And so everything had seemed impossible beyond that. And here I was 4 years later running 110 miles.
This is a really odd question, but did you just instantly enjoy it? And was it also part of getting out into that countryside that you love so much that was driving you on, particularly with ultra runs?
I enjoy life. I mean, the first ultra of the Marlborough Downs Challenge, I vividly remember how horrible it was. But I guess I love the feeling afterwards. We all know that, don't we? We all finish the race. The race is horrible. We finish the race. Feel great. Say we're never doing it again. Sign up for the next one like 12 hours or 12 days later, depending on who you are. I don't know. I think like the partying hard stuff, like I was very good at staying up all night going at it. And it was just transferring that energy into running. And it's not a new story, is it? People with addictive personalities moving from sashaying from one thing into the other. And so, yeah, I've got all that energy. So just redirecting it to there. I love being outside. I love wildlife. I love the landscape. I love looking at old things because my dad's an archaeologist. So I've got a good eye for there's a Bronze Age barrow. There's an old church. You can see all the stuff out there, the topography of the landscape, then all the wildlife. There's just so much to do and see and think about out there. On top of which, you're pushing yourself to your limit, trying to run 50 miles or 110 miles or whatever it is you're doing that day. So yeah, it's just great, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, I think we all find that strange sort of masochism in some of the longer distances that we end up really enjoying afterwards. And I'm guessing also a little bit like the Secret Tory, it's been able to give you this platform to talk about all the things that you want to talk about.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? I feel really lucky. I've always said from the start, because I was never an athlete. I was terrible at sport at school. I've just got a human body. I believe everyone can run an ultra marathon if they want to. It's not to do with whether you're a gifted athlete or not. It's to do with whether you've got the mindset or the willingness to do it. And so I've trained so many people over the years, and every single one of them was like, this seems impossible. Before that first race, they're like, they don't know if they can do it. And everyone always does it if you're in the mindset of doing it. And I'll say this to anyone, like if you come to me morbidly obese or you're completely lacking in self-confidence or something, everyone can do it. Some people will take longer to get there than others, but the body itself is capable of running an ultra marathon. And everyone, if it's like fully functioning, everyone is capable of doing that. It's all in your mind and in your head. And doing that first ultra marathon completely unlocked something in me, that first 110 miles, because it seemed so impossible. And ever since then, everything seemed really, like, it's made everything easier since then. I've run my own business. I run a music festival with my wife, done this Twitter account, which got 200,000 people following it. And all of that has come, I don't know if I'd have tried to do any of those things if I hadn't done this thing, this ultra marathon, which I previously thought was impossible, and pushed myself to do it. It's just given me so much confidence. And I'm wanting to transfer that to other people and say, it's changed my life. I'd love to be able to help you do that. If you believe what I'm saying, I can help you do that.
Also, when you're along that journey, I guess there's a lot of hard physical work as well. What tips do you give as a personal trainer and an ultra runner to people who are looking to take on those distances?
I have to qualify it as I'm a terrible ultra runner. I just sort of pull myself around. But I mean, I'd say The first few ones, I was really over-influenced by other runners. You know what you do. You go online and you see people saying, I'm running 750 miles a week at the moment. A bit undercut. I'm going to put it to 800 miles. Just this absolute nonsense. And a lot of bravado about how many miles you can get in. And so I tried to copy that for the first few years of doing it, being sort of wet behind the ears and not having the experience myself to know what worked for me. And that just, it kind of worked at first. And then I got a bit older and just picked up loads and loads of injuries. I completely reversed it and just took what I knew as a personal trainer about energy systems and how your body works and needing to recover, and just worked really hard on, like, you know, 5K speed intervals, doing really hard sessions, which you like a vial, your 800 meters on the track, your hill repeats, stuff like that. Not needing to go out and try and do 25 miles, 30 miles every weekend, like lots of other ultras, runners brag. And once I started doing that, I got loads better at it. And also the gym work, spending time in the gym, squatting, deadlifting, lunging, which I was always a bit resistant to doing, because a couple of days with really heavy legs because you've been in the gym means you can't go out running. And so you start feeling, oh, I think I might skip the leg session this week because it'll take me off 2 days running in an enjoyable way. But actually, it's so worth it. Injury proofs you, makes you much better at going up and down the hills, because I was running on trails. And like, just, you know, those strong quads coming down a really steep hill, there's such a difference. You can like just feel how much more control you've got doing it. So yeah, I was going from like, well, I don't know, however many miles I got up to, 70 miles a week or whatever, down to like 20, 30 miles a week, especially with busyness with jobs and stuff. And honestly, that was so much better for me for the really long distances.
Yeah. And do you have any other events or challenges coming up at the moment, or for what?
As I alluded to at the start of the show, I'm very busy right now. Yeah. I added it up a while ago, and I think I'm on about 45 ultras. So I'd like to get up to 50 ultras. A lot of them I've done under my own steam, like around the Pembrokeshire coast down here a few years ago. That was absolutely beautiful. That's 185 miles, absolutely gorgeous place. I live in West Wales now, and it's things about living here is the running. So I've got nothing in my calendar, but the thing in my head at the moment, I did the Hen Harriers around the north of England. It's with Chris Packham's charity, who he does with Mark Avery and Ruth Tingay, called Wild Justice. And we highlighted this Hen Harrier persecution. And in Scotland, they have all these grouse moors as well. I think a fifth of Scotland's land mass is grouse moor, largely owned by royals and that, you know, that lot. And they're equally desolate places for wildlife. And the reason we don't have golden eagles, someone might try and sue me for saying this, but it's true. The reason we don't have golden eagles in this country is because so many of them are killed up in Scotland on grouse moors. We would probably have them definitely in the Yorkshire Dales, in Snowdonia. Maybe there's one there at the moment, even down as low as the Peak District. But we don't get there because they get killed. Because they're also satellite tagged, and we also find that they all die on grouse moors. You know, these magnificent birds, which are probably worth huge amounts for tourism in their own right, let alone just the sort of natural right for all of us to be able to see these magnificent creatures out in the wild. And we're getting shot for posh people, so that posh people can shoot a different type of bird. So I'm going to do the same thing I did for the Hen Harriers, but between the Golden Eagle satellite tags. So probably harder running over the highlands around that sort of area. I don't know if I'll be able to do all the places I've been shot, because there's so many, or poisoned, or trapped, but not just shot. But I think that's the next big one. So that might be next year or the year after. But I'm quite optimistic and excited about that, because I did this first, but last time I didn't have a big Twitter following. Now I've got 200,000 people I can talk to. I reckon I'll be able to generate quite a buzz and quite a lot of attention for it. I don't know how you feel having heard me talk about it, but I've found every single person I've ever explained what happens on grouse moors too, but sort of joke, but get a bit slap-jawed and they say, what? But you just don't know about it or hear about it because it happens out of sight, out of mind, and they're just left to get on with it. And I want to stop that.
Well, that was actually something that was going through my mind as you were saying it, really, that we don't really hear about it, or I certainly haven't. I'm sure someone will point to somewhere where it's been, but I haven't heard about it on a news channel or read about it in a newspaper. And I just wonder whether that comes back to part of what you were doing with the Secret Tory, is to try and raise these issues that the media, and I'm an ex-journalist, exactly, but the media isn't necessarily talking about.
Exactly. I mean, it was never an objective to start with, but now I find myself, I can talk to a city's worth of people on Twitter in my pocket, in between dropping my daughter at school filling up the car with diesel. That's good for an environmentalist, isn't it? So yeah, I've got that platform to try and highlight it. And I was the same. I didn't know anything about it. It was only because I was on Twitter, but I saw, I think it was Ruth Tingay. Follow her blog, Raptor Persecution, on Twitter. Go and have a look for that, because that really highlights the issues much better than I can do. And I was like, what is this? What's this bird that's almost extinct because people are killing it? How does that go on? Why don't we know about it? So yeah, she brought it to my attention. And now I'm in this unique position of being able to bring it to other people's attention. I've just written a new book called The Diary of a Secret Royal. And in it, I've got a couple of funny scenes on grouse moors where the queen goes up in an attack helicopter to shoot grouse because she's getting a bit old and she can't lift the gun anymore. So there's a little plug for that.
I'm quite interested, actually, because I've spoken to some guests about this recently as well, in the kind of link sometimes between particularly ultra runners and environmental causes. You see it in things like the green runners and so on, and it does seem to be a thing. I just wonder if, I mean, do you think it's as simple as, you know, ultra runners run out in the countryside so they know what it's all about?
I suspect that's part of it. I mean, if you're living and working in Dartmouth Park in North London, you care about your local community, you care about the bins not being empty on the streets, you ring the council and say that. If you're out running in the hillsides every day, you take an interest in what's going on up there. But also, it's just symbiotic, isn't it? Mutually beneficial. You're up there, it's gorgeous, it makes sense that you want to protect it. And you want to share it with other people and let other people know what's up there. I think one of my favourite things about ultra running is you get so much further, you penetrate so much further into the landscape than you do on a walk. Like I live near the Preseli Hills here, and where I walk with friends who come and visit, or my wife and daughter, you can get up to like one hill and back again, and that's your walk. I can set off on a run, I can cover like four or five tops in an hour and go right into it and see it all, and see all these amazing views and these old stone circles and things. And it's just breathtaking and fantastic. And you just want to share it with other people. And one of the ways of sharing it with other people is telling them about it. Another is to tell them to go out running. And another is to sort of try and preserve the landscape for future people. Because if we're going to live on a planet that's been scoured away by flooding and ravaged by droughts in the summer, there's going to be a lot less nice landscape for us to go and look at.
Just finally, what's the future for the Twitter account now? Is it going to be more of you? Are we going to see the secret diary of a Labour MP in another year when they maybe get elected?
Well, if I was corrupt and venal as this lot, yes. I mean, I've just done my diary of the secret royal. I think this is the first time I've ever talked to anyone about it. But the future of the Twitter account is a good question. My dad messaged the other day saying something about I like the way. It was sort of suggesting there was a new character on the Twitter account, which I was pretending to be, but I think it's just me on there. it just he doesn't know that much about me. I don't know. I definitely want to kind of work this angle of everyone being obsessed. I mean, I've talked about it more than because I'm on the podcast talking about my mullet, but everyone seems to be obsessed with it. So, I mean, working this angle of looking like a redneck who smells, according to GB News, might be the way to go. But yeah, I mean, let's see what the future holds. There's a lot of nappies at the moment. There's a music festival to organise, and there's runs to be getting out on in my spare time. So actually strategising my Twitter account's direction isn't quite high up the priority list, sadly.
Well, I think we'll all be looking to see what comes next there. And I wish you best of luck with it, but also best of luck with getting out there and doing some more trail running and some more ultra running when time allows it. So, Henry, thank Absolutely. You so much. Thank you so much for joining me today on the Running Tales podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks again to Henry Morris for joining us today on the Running Tales podcast. I really hope you enjoyed Henry's story as much as I did. Something a little bit different, but plenty of running involved along the way. If you did enjoy it, please head over to wherever you listen to our podcast and give us a 5-star rating and a review. It's so, so important for us to keep growing this podcast, and it helps other people find interesting stories like that of Henry Morris. Now, we're just going to leave you today with a little bit more, in fact, all of that big secret Tory reveal video. The voices you hear along the way are Henry Morris, Jacob Rees-Mogg, and Michael Gove. See you next week.
Rogue UK Twitter account The Secret Tory is wanted for distracting the Tory government from concentrating on national self-impoverishment by forcing them to firefight puerile accusations instead. If you have any information relating to their identity, Crime Stoppers are offering a £500 community cash reward.
Wait, they're offering £500 to catch that Secret Tory!
Nice one. I hate his rubbish brand of budget satire, tweeted from a downstairs toilet at 5:30 a.m.
Alrighty! Let's round up a posse to get rid of him!
We'll need the best of the best. The brightest of the brightest.
I had an economy, but I lost it.
I just done a bump in the River Stour!
It's easy to slacken!
I'm gonna paintball him into next week.
On second thoughts, we'll handle this ourselves.
Bobby Brown Envelopes has had a tip-off.
I know a guy who works down Bedford Screwfix, and he's seen a guy in the car park there selling unsold copies of Diary of a Secret Tory for people to heat their homes with.
Tell us, Scooby!
Hey, what's that?
Oh, it's a Secret Tory! Mate, create a diversion!
Hey, what are you doing?
Holding all the cards.
No, you're not.
Leveling up.
Get out of my way!
Shitting in this river.
What's your problem, mate?
A chronic inability to tell the truth and ringworm.
Hey, let the satirical hillbilly on its way!
Dickhead!
Jacob, what have you done?
You fuck around, you find out, mate.
Yeah, Ben, it's Henry. You'll never guess who I just saw. No, not Eamon Holmes. I haven't seen him since Beefy's last dogging session in Epping Forest. Yeah, no, excellent. No, Michael Gove! Yeah, really? No. There's no way I could have known I'm the Henry Morris who's been amateurishly lampooning his party's proto-fascist antics. What did it sound like? Well, come to think of it, he spoke with exactly the same voice
we do for him in the Tories. Rest in pieces, Secret Tory.